Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Syria has a chance at a better future, but some Syrians say that first means revisiting the atrocities of the recent past.
We have to remember this very well so it doesn't happen again.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler, processing history to move ahead in Syria. Also, President Trump had a long conversation with Vladimir Putin today about Ukraine.
We'll hear more on the prospects for a ceasefire and in Mozambique how extremists connected to ISIS are threatening parts of the country.
Groups like Al-Shabaab can operate in this kind of lawless area in the far north without hindrance almost.
Plus, in Mexico's capital, we meet the people who are saving this iconic music across the city.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for joining us today. The new government in Syria says it is taking steps to address the atrocities of the past. After 13 years of brutal civil war and decades of dynastic rule by the Assad family, there is a lot to account for.
Syria's interim president, Ahmed al-Shara, put out a statement over the weekend saying the government will set up two commissions, one for transitional justice and one for missing persons. It's about compensating the victims of the former regime and finding out what happened to the people who went missing. Our next story is about someone who fled his native Syria more than a decade ago and has now returned home to bear witness. His name is Ala Hassan. He's a photographer who left Syria in 2013, first coming to the U.S. and then going to Germany. The World's Shirin Jafari spent some time with him recently in the Syrian capital, Damascus.
I meet Ala Hassan in his blue 2008 Fiat Punto, the car that has become sort of his second home these days.
You know, I call it Fifi because it's a Fiat.
Since he returned to Syria a week after the fall of Assad, Fifi has been Hassan's window into the country, a way to rediscover places he knew intimately. He's working on a photography project to capture life amid the destruction left by the war. He drives around, sometimes taking pictures from inside his car if it's not safe to get out. I join him on the ride.
Technical test?
Yeah. Hassan grew up in Damascus, in a family touched by Assad's brutality even before the war. In the 1980s, his father was detained for his leftist political views, and Hassan says his entire childhood was spent visiting him at Sednaya prison, the place where people went to disappear. In 2011, when the uprisings began, Hassan was in his 20s. Young, sure, he says, but not naive.
We all knew there was potential, you know, to get detained, to get shot or whatever, and we knew the risk we were taking. We had nothing to lose, to be honest. We had no future.
Hassan took part in protests and helped smuggle food and medicine into areas besieged by the government forces.
It was a revolution, for real. It was like what they write about in books. You actually feel on top of the world. You feel that you're right all the time and that you're standing up for what's right.
But what started as a simple protest quickly turned deadly and violent. One by one, Hassan's friends were killed or disappeared by the security forces. It was clear to Hassan that he could no longer stay in Syria. In 2013, he left the country. In Turkey, he married his American girlfriend and they headed to New York. But he says his heart never left the streets of Damascus and its surrounding areas.
I lost all my topics, so I couldn't take pictures of anything meaningful for me. I was covering this area where we are right now. We are in the east side of Damascus.
He also felt guilty for having survived the civil war and for being able to leave the country. In 2019, Hassan says he felt like the revolution had failed, that Syrians would have to forever be envious of the Tunisians who'd managed to oust their dictator, Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali. Meanwhile, it seemed like that the world had forgotten about all of Assad's atrocities. The Syrian leader was being reintegrated into the international community, meeting with heads of states and traveling around the region.
I had to accept the new reality of the country, that we are no longer this well-educated, middle-class-dominated country in the middle of the Middle East. We are actually one of the most devastated countries with high poverty rates and not very high literacy rates, and we have a long road ahead of us to build up, you know?
What Hassan and so many others didn't know at the time was that in about 5 years, Assad's empire would crumble, and that none of his powerful allies, like Iran and Russia, would be able to stop his downfall. On December 8th, that is exactly what happened.
We were just feeling the enjoyment of the humiliation of the person that humiliated us for, you know, our entire lives.
Hassan says the first thing he noticed when he returned to Syria was how tired people looked. Years of war, oppression, and sanctions had left Syrians exhausted.
So do you mind if we get out?
The sun casts a golden light on the crumbling buildings surrounding us in the neighborhood of Jobar, just outside of Damascus. What used to be apartment blocks, schools, and playgrounds are now piles of rubble. It's eerily quiet.
Why are there bullets?
As Hassan snaps his pictures, we hear gunfire in the distance. There's been some sectarian tensions in recent days. We figure it's that or some bored men shooting for fun. Hassan is looking for signs of life amid the rubble, trees, shrubs, the odd stray dog. And then, suddenly, he notices some birds.
It's a sparrow going around like,
It's sparrow season, he remembers.
It's like hunting, no? Yeah, I got it. I got a good one.
Driving around, taking photos, and speaking with people here, for Hassan, this is a form of resistance. Resistance against forgetting.
It's important for everyone to remember what had happened and that what we are able to do to each other, what we are capable of doing, and how much destruction it took until one person gave up power. We have to remember this very well so it doesn't happen again.
Hassan hopes to publish a photo book once the project is complete. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari, Damascus, Syria.
President Trump got on the phone today separately with the leaders of Ukraine and Russia. He spoke briefly with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and then talked with Russian leader Vladimir Putin for more than 2 hours. This comes after Russia carried out a massive drone attack over the weekend. According to officials in Ukraine, Russia launched 273 drones in all, making it the biggest such attack since the start of the full-scale invasion in 2022. The World's Daniel Offman has been following all these developments from Washington. Daniel, what do we know about President Trump's conversations with Zelensky and Putin?
Yeah, so as you noted, Carolyn, Trump first spoke with Zelensky briefly, and then he spoke with Putin for more than 2 hours. On the Russian side, Putin called the conversation constructive, and he said that the Russian and Ukrainian sides are working towards peace and are looking for compromises that satisfy both sides. Trump also came out with a statement in a social media post. He said that the phone call went very well and that Moscow and Kyiv will immediately start negotiations towards a ceasefire and an end to the war. So far, though, Russia hasn't budged from most of its maximalist demands, which are non-starters for Ukraine. And on the Ukrainian side, Zelensky, he's been communicating that he's much more flexible than Putin and that he's even open to an unconditional ceasefire. Russia and Ukraine here, they're trying to show President Trump that they're willing to negotiate and that they want peace. But there's a high level of mistrust between Russia and Ukraine and skepticism that a ceasefire could actually be achieved. All that together, though, neither side wants to be blamed by the Trump administration for undermining this negotiation process.
So, Daniel, this is the latest in a string of diplomatic maneuverings over this war. Last week, we saw a lot of diplomatic activity. Did anything concrete come out of those meetings? Are these calls a result of those meetings?
These calls are a continuation of that. But in terms of the meetings in Turkey on Friday last week, not as much came out of them as was hoped. It seemed like there was a possibility that President Putin and President Zelensky could meet face to face for the first time since before Russia's full-scale invasion. That didn't happen because Putin was a no-show. But a Ukrainian delegation, they did meet with a Russian delegation for the first time since March of 2022. Both sides came out with at least some results. The highlight of it was that they agreed to a prisoner swap, which would be 1,000 for 1,000 prisoners of war. That exchange, if it were to happen, it would be the largest prisoner swap between the two countries since the start of the war.
So what are the governments in Ukraine and Russia saying about this whole diplomatic process?
Well, on the U.S., Ukrainian, and European side, there's been this push for weeks now for a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine. And we've heard Russia reject that proposal, saying that it wants to work towards a more comprehensive solution to the conflict. Ukraine and other European countries, they've called that a delay tactic. So at the same time, you have the U.S. position, which is to continue engaging with Russia and Putin directly. Here's what Secretary of State Marco Rubio said yesterday in an interview on CBS.
One of the things that could help break this logjam, perhaps the only thing that can, is a direct conversation between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. And he's already openly expressed a desire and a belief that that needs to happen. And hopefully that'll be worked out soon as well.
So, Daniel, now that that one-on-one talk between President Trump and Vladimir Putin has happened, what happens next?
Well, there is one notable shift here, that the U.S. and Ukraine, at least publicly, are trying to show that they're on the same page again. There was an in-person meeting between Zelensky, Rubio, and Vice President J.D. Vance in Rome over the weekend. Both sides said it was a productive meeting. So that kind of tone is much different from the famous White House meeting back in February that went completely off the rails. Also, as we noted, Trump got on the phone with Zelensky both before and after this conversation with Putin. So we're seeing more coordination between the two sides. Looking forward, though, the Trump administration, they've said many times that if they don't see progress in these negotiations, that they're willing to walk away. What that actually means, though, is unclear, but we've seen that tomorrow the EU and potentially the US could coordinate with a new package of sanctions against Russia. So that would mark a shift in the US approach, at least since Trump has come to office, and it would show that the US is willing to put additional pressure on Russia, not just Ukraine, to come to the negotiating table.
Lots of talking, though, we assume, still to come. The World's Daniel Hoffman is in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Carolyn.
It seems almost like it has always been there, but it's actually been only 20 years since it was dreamed up, and even then it took a few years to really catch on.
Say hello to the like button. For internet users to, with a click of a mouse, exclaim their preference for a bit of information.
Nowadays, the like button gets clicked more than 7 billion times a day. That little thumbs up has been massively consequential and is a subject of a new book.
The like button was pivotal in the rise of the $220 billion social media industry.
That's from the audiobook version of Like, the Button That Changed the World. Bob Goodson co-authored the book with Martin Reeves and says he came up with the idea of a like button in 2005 when he worked for Yelp.
Liking is what I describe as the atomic unit of user-generated content.
In other words, that little dopamine hit you feel when your post receives likes is what draws us into deeper online engagement.
Goodson, who spoke to the Data Camp podcast, says there's $3 trillion up for grabs every day from people on the internet. Companies rely on the like button to tap into that ocean of revenue.
We suspect that this feature is one of the things that made the success of the customer experience industry possible in the last, 10 or 20 years.
What's currently the subject of debate is how all of this impacts those of us who use Facebook and other social media sites. Seon is a fraud detection and prevention company that puts out a podcast called The Context. Host Gergo Varga says our phones provide the equivalent of digital crack enabled by that little thumbs up symbol.
The apps keep you hooked. All the notifications that you have are based on whether other people like you or not. We are constantly on our phones because we are afraid that we're going to miss something from our feeds. But studies do show that if you take a break from social media, you get better.
A break from social media. Consider this my analog like for that idea.
Israel is pursuing a new offensive in Gaza. Just ahead, we'll explain its stated goal and the widespread criticism. You're listening to The World.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Israel says it is seeking control over all of the Gaza Strip. That's according to a statement from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Over the weekend, the Israeli military began a new offensive in Gaza and has now ordered the evacuation of one of the territory's biggest cities. Netanyahu also acknowledged yesterday that people there are on the verge of starvation. He said that Israel will now allow a limited amount of humanitarian aid into Gaza after blocking the entry of most aid for the past 10 or so weeks. Ibrahim Sharif Al-Ashi is a dentist in northern Gaza. He sent us a voice memo describing the situation there.
Families are living in rubble, hospitals are under attack, medical workers are being killed, and people are dying from wounds that would be, I think, would be treatable anywhere else in the world. We are living in disaster situation right now.
For more about Israel's new military offensive, we reached out to Neri Zilber. He's a journalist with the Financial Times based in Tel Aviv.
About 5 Israeli military divisions, infantry, armor, and the like, are now working and operating inside the Gaza Strip in the north, central, and southern parts of the Strip. And they're working slowly but methodically to move farther inland from where they were on the far edges of the Strip, further inland. And the primary target at the moment, we believe, will be the southern city of Khan Yunis, because earlier today, the Israeli military issued an evacuation order for the entire city. And so that is likely the next target. But really, the military operation is meant to supplement and solidify the ongoing ceasefire negotiations in Doha, Israel trying to seek leverage over Hamas to soften Hamas's positions.
Is there a death toll that's been reported by the Gaza Health Ministry since this new offensive started?
I believe over 100 people inside the Gaza Strip have been killed just today. And this comes over several days after airstrikes picked up starting last week. So really, the death toll inside Gaza has picked up as Israel has both threatened and now begun officially its new offensive. And according to the Israeli military, there will be gradual phases to this operation. Again, it's meant to target Hamas militants and militant infrastructure inside Gaza, and also in Israeli minds to apply pressure on Hamas to, again, come to the table and at least initially release the remaining hostages that Hamas holds. But yes, that's what we're looking at the moment. And as the prime minister said earlier today, the goal is perhaps eventually up to and including conquering the entire Gaza Strip.
What exactly does that mean? I mean, Netanyahu has said he wants Israel to fully control Gaza. What exactly would that look like?
Well, on this issue, and perhaps this issue only, I take the Netanyahu government at their word. If Hamas does not cave at the negotiating table and both releases the remaining hostages, nearly 60 people, 20 of whom are still believed to be alive, as well as lay down its weapons and essentially surrender, then I do believe Israel and the Israeli military will go all the way to reconquer the entirety of the Gaza Strip. By the way, something that did not happen even over the course of 19 months of pretty heavy and devastating war. And Israel aims to reconquer, take over the entire Gaza Strip, and then methodically clear the area of remaining Hamas gunmen, militants, and infrastructure. That, as you can imagine, is not an operation that you can measure in weeks, perhaps not months, but perhaps years.
You say the Israeli government is positioning this new offensive as part of its negotiations. So they're doing this to have more leverage at the negotiating table with Hamas. Where are those negotiations right now, and why has it been so difficult to make any progress on those to date?
So negotiations are still ongoing, as the offensive has officially begun in Doha, in Qatar, via U.S., Egyptian, and Qatari mediation. So you do have an Israeli negotiating team, as well as Hamas officials, sitting in Doha, not together, but indirectly, and trying to figure out some formula to at least bring a temporary halt to the war. And there are two different avenues that the Trump administration officials are pursuing. Number one is a temporary halt of, say, 2 months, where Hamas would release some hostages and the war would be paused with an eye to perhaps a longer term deal. That's proving difficult because Hamas may understand that this is only a temporary pause and that from Hamas's point of view, it wants a full stop to the war. The second problem with that second avenue being pursued by negotiators is a full end to the war. But the problem there is that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not willing to end the war until Hamas essentially surrenders and lays down its arms. And that's something Hamas has so far been unwilling to accept.
This all comes as hunger and starvation are on the rise in Gaza. Israel's government says its blockade on Gaza is lifted and some aid will be allowed in. So how will that aid get into people's hands?
So the major shift as of last night by the Israeli government is that it has agreed tentatively to allow the UN to bring in some food as a bridge, as they call it, to this new plan, which would likely cut out or at least co-opt the previous UN-led mechanism. This mechanism, again, supported by the Trump administration and the Israeli government, being led by private military security contractors from the U.S. and the idea there is to circumvent Hamas and try to get aid into the Gaza Strip. But as UN agencies are very skeptical that this plan can work under the terms that have been put forward so far, it remains unclear who's going to fund this plan, where the aid will actually come from, and once it's inside the Gaza Strip, how it will be distributed to over 2 million very, very needy people.
Trump has backed the Israeli government's war aims in Gaza, but there does seem to be more daylight. There was the negotiation for the hostage Adon Alexander last week that seemed to basically circumvent the Netanyahu government. Right now, how close are the U.S. and Israel when it comes to the long-term goals for this war?
The Israeli government has the backing of the Trump administration so far, but really it depends on the mood and whims and priorities of one person, which is U.S. President Donald Trump. And so I don't think anybody can predict where those head, you know, from a day-to-day basis. But I will say that so far, yes, there has been pressure on Israel to at least come to the negotiating table with Hamas to, yes, allow at least some more aid into the Gaza Strip. But I'm still not convinced that the Trump administration, when push comes to shove, will actually force Israel to end the war full stop. I think on that point, there is a lot of understanding in Washington for Israel's position that Hamas essentially has to surrender before this war comes to an end. But that remains to be determined. And again, if this war drags on for several more weeks or months, the patience of the U.S. president will be put to the test.
Neri Zilber reports for the Financial Times, and he spoke with us from Tel Aviv.
The agriculture minister in Japan is getting heat for comments he made about rice over the weekend. Taku Eto told people at a party fundraiser yesterday that he's never had to buy rice because his supporters give him more than he needs.
Those remarks went over like a lead balloon because rice is the basic staple in Japan, and right now it's in short supply there, selling at inflated prices.
Eto also made a comment about pebbles in the rice supply, comments that farmers thought were offensive. The price of rice is about twice as high as it was last year at this time. Japanese authorities recently released about 310,000 metric tons of rice from the government stockpile in an attempt to bring the price down.
Another release from the stockpile is expected later this month. Opposition parties in Japan are accusing the agriculture minister of being tone-deaf. Eto says he regrets the remarks.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Mexico City, organ grinders have long provided a key part of the city's soundscape. They play hand-cranked organs, usually mounted on carts. The instruments were imported from Germany in the late 1800s and then loaded up with Mexican songs, kind of like an old player piano. They're heard in plazas and parks where musicians crank the organs for tips. But as the world's TBSi Zeo reports, the tradition is fading. As part of her series about the iconic sounds of Mexico City, TB brings us a story of the folks working to keep these vintage instruments alive.
Inside a crowded workshop in the neighborhood of Tepito, Silvia Hernandez has spent decades restoring organillos.
A reparar las cajas, tallarlas, limpiarlas. Dentro se deterioran las teclas.
Repairing the wooden cases, tuning the pipes, adjusting the gears, aligning the paper rolls. These century-old instruments are hand-cranked and play pre-programmed melodies. Hernandez's husband was a successful organ repairman, but she didn't learn the trade from him.
Porque mi esposo nunca nos dejaba entrar al taller. ¿Ustedes en su cocina?
Because he thought women didn't belong in the workshop, but in the kitchen. But after he died, Hernandez needed income, and she began teaching herself how to fix these organs.
Desarmando. Desarmé un cilindro.
By disassembling the instruments. Over time, she mastered the craft. She had no idea her skills would become vital for the future of this tradition. Hernandez is one of only four organillo repair specialists left in Mexico City, and the only woman among them. Today, there are an estimated 500 organ grinders in Mexico City, and most work around the downtown area.
Yo siempre le he llamado que es el sonido melancólico del centro histórico.
This is the melancholic sound of the historic center of Mexico City, says Alberto Contreras, a full-time organ grinder wearing the typical beige military-style uniform.
Llegan a pesar hasta 50 kilos.
He says back in the day, people would strap on 100-pound organillos and carry them around the city. Now, most of these organs are put on carts, making the job more bearable. These days, organ grinders live off of tips, and they don't make much.
Lo máximo que hemos llegado a ganar son 300, 250 en un día, trabajado bien desde la mañana hasta la tarde.
Alexis Gomez says, on a good day, he might bring in 300 pesos or $15. He's 20 years old, which is unusually young for this profession. He wanted an easy job to help him pay for school, but he's already regretting it.
Sí, se está perdiendo porque también la gente se está aburriendo.
People are getting bored of it, he says, because most organs play the same old songs and many are out of tune. The instruments themselves are no longer manufactured. He's already looking for another job, but for those who stay in the profession, it's not about income. It's about saving a fading tradition.
Aquí en este lugar estamos desde 1884. Yo vengo siendo la tercera generación.
Mario Luna's family has been playing these organillos since 1884, and he says it would be sad to see them disappear.
Si con estos instrumentos aquí se conocieron los abuelitos, los bisabuelos.
This plaza is where many grandparents and great-grandparents first met, he says, over organ serenades. In recent years, the local government has stepped in to help preserve the tradition. Just this weekend, the city hosted its third annual Organ Grinder Festival, with performances, workshops, and public demonstrations. Back in the repair shop, Silvia Hernandez is now training her granddaughter to carry on her work. Samantha sees it as an existential mission.
Pues que apoyen al organillero estando aquí o cuando vengan de visita.
She's asking the public to support organ grinders, give them good tips, and appreciate their job. She and her grandma are determined to keep the tradition alive, and every organ they bring back to life is a step in that direction. For the world, I'm TBSi Zea, Mexico City.
Tune in tomorrow for the next of TB's stories about the unique sounds of Mexico City. We'll meet the DJs behind the city's sonideros, or street dance parties. That's tomorrow on The World.
There were three national elections held in Europe this weekend, and each had a different storyline.
Romania elected a new president. Nicoșor Dan is a centrist pro-European Union politician who was not projected to win. The election was seen as a choice for Romanian voters between East and West. An earlier round of voting was annulled after allegations of Russian interference.
Portugal also went to the polls, and the results there were mixed. No single party won an outright majority. That means the minority government of the center-right Democratic Alliance will now be at the mercy of opposition parties. Prime Minister Luis Montenegro is expected to remain in office. He called the snap election after becoming embroiled this spring in accusations of conflict of interest.
And finally, Poland held a first round of voting for president on Sunday, a good day for the far right and a warning sign for moderates. Two candidates topped a large slate of also-rans. Liberal Warsaw Mayor Rafał Trzaskowski, who is endorsed by Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk, and conservative Karol Nawrocki. He got a nod from Donald Trump. Polls can look ahead to a nail-biting second-round election on June 1st. One analyst predicted the next 2 weeks of campaigning will be polarizing and brutal. Stay with us for more as Election Day in Poland approaches.
Britain is back on the world stage. That's the message from Prime Minister Keir Starmer today. He spoke at a landmark summit in London with leaders from the European Union. 9 years after the UK's referendum to leave the EU, the so-called Brexit, this meeting is being called a reset, with both parties back at the negotiating table, talking security, trade, energy, travel, and fisheries. But not everyone is on board. Some Brexit supporters do not like what they see. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, is here to explain. Hey, Orla.
Hey, Marco.
So this does seem like a really big deal. Nearly a decade after the referendum and 5 years after Britain officially quit the EU. What's at stake here, Orla?
Yes, symbolically, it is a very big deal, but symbolically so. I mean, relations between the two sides have been notoriously rocky. We've spoken about them many times in the past during the Brexit negotiations. Keir Starmer has always been keen to try and smooth things over since he took over as Prime Minister and desperate to improve trade relations between the two because the EU is Britain's closest trading partner. So it really wants to iron out a lot of those bureaucracy details that we saw holding trade up at the borders. It's important to say that today doesn't change the fundamentals of what Britain voted for when it comes to Brexit. It's still outside the EU, it's still outside the single EU customs market, but it is a sort of a coming together of the two sides that we haven't seen in, well, 9 years. And the EU's Commission Chief, Ursula von der Leyen, said today it's more than just a new chapter in the relationship between the two.
The message we are sending to the world today is equally, if not more important. It is a message that at a time of global instability and when our continent faces the greatest threat it has for generations, we in Europe stick together.
So do we know what actual agreements have been reached at this meeting?
Well, we know some details. We know, for example, there will be reduced border checks on food and drink. So some of those routine checks on animal and plant products, they have been removed completely. So, for example, British sausages and burgers, they're going to be sold back into the EU again. So there was some cheeriness among people about that today. And also on the issue of defence, we heard the two sides have agreed on a new partnership that will allow the UK access this $200 billion EU weapons fund, which has been announced in the last few months. And this will allow UK firms to bid for defence contracts. Where it got thorny, though, was the issue of fish.
Yeah, fish, right. I mean, at the time when the UK decided to leave the EU, fishermen voted, right? They were Brexit supporters.
They were big Brexit supporters. I think the figure at the time was around 90% of fishers had said that they wanted Brexit to happen. The Brexit Party campaigned very strongly on let's take back control of not only our borders, but also our waters. And from next year, what was supposed to happen was that the EU would gradually reduce its fishing quota in UK waters by 25%. But today, Keir Starmer announced that the EU boats would continue to have have access to British waters for the next 12 years. Mm. Fishermen across the country came out in irritation with it. Today, I spoke to one, Jimmy Buchan is his name. He's now CEO of the Scottish Seafood Association. He wasn't all doom and gloom. He said, you know, there might be a drop in cost for some of them, but he felt that Starmer had capitulated to the EU once again.
The whole idea of Brexit was to get the control of our waters back into UK sovereignty. What the UK should have done was take back control and then renegotiate who fishes in our waters where and when.
Mm. I'm also wondering, Orla, how do opposition lawmakers and Brexiteers who triumphed in their split with the EU nearly 10 years ago, how do they feel about today's summit in London?
Yeah, the words being bandied about today are words like betrayal and surrender. Boris Johnson tweeted that it was an appalling sellout. Wow. Nigel Farage talked about betrayal. Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the opposition Conservative Party, said it was very problematic that Britain has become a rule taker from Brussels once again. She said there's a new agreement allowing some young people under 30 to maybe move freely, more freely from the EU to work and study in the UK. Now, we don't know the full details of that, but she said that might see an increase in migrant numbers, for example. So Brexiteers generally pretty unhappy, Remainers certainly more content.
So the Brexit referendum 10 years ago, the UK agonized over it for more than 5 years before it went into effect. Now this renegotiation is on the table. Does this feel like a never-ending story about how Brits and Europeans write the rules of how they get along?
It's certainly how fishermen and fisherwomen feel today. I can tell you that from talking to them this morning. They are so frustrated with how things have changed and changed again and changed again. Many of those who campaigned for Brexit made it sound very easy. It was always going to be very complicated. Trade negotiators that we spoke to many times back in 2015, 2016 told us this is going to take years to figure out. This is a much longer process than what's being put forward by the side. And that's the reality of what we're looking at today.
Orla Barry is the world's Europe correspondent. Orla, thanks as always.
Thanks, Marco.
Haitians all over the world celebrated Flag Day over the weekend. In the town of Camp-Perret in Haiti, a local YouTuber captured the celebration on the streets. School kids are marching, motorcycles racing, brass bands are playing. Pretty much everyone is either carrying a red and blue Haitian flag or wearing one. In Boston, the celebrations continue as a new cultural center named after one of Haiti's heroes opens to the public tomorrow. GBH's Esteban Bustillos was there last Flag Day when they broke ground.
The old state house is a monument to revolution hidden in plain sight. On this day, commuters, tourists, and street vendors are passing by the 18th century building that witnessed the Boston Massacre, which helped spark the American Revolution. Sitting just across the street from that old American home, Charlot Lucien, founder of the Haitian Artists Assembly of Massachusetts, has a revolutionary on his mind. But this one is Haitian, Toussaint Louverture. Louverture was a leader of the Haitian Revolution. In fact, Lucien compares him to two American icons, Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln.
Of course, I could have named a few abolitionists as well, but the weight of the historical mission that Lincoln had to take on his shoulder to me is comparable to what Toussaint Louverture had to deal with.
The Toussaint Louverture Cultural Center of Massachusetts will act as a gathering place and resource for local Haitians, and organizers hope it will help the legacy of one of history's great leaders live on. Louverture was a military leader and statesman. He faced off with the imperial powers of France, Britain, and Spain. His leadership paved the way for the only successful revolt of enslaved people in history. Regine Michelle Jean-Charles is the director of Africana Studies at Northeastern. She compares Louverture to another great American, Harriet Tubman. Louverture is a larger-than-life figure these days, but Jean-Charles stresses that he didn't see himself as the revolution's only hero.
We're very much about the collective, the collaborative, the understanding that l'union fait la force, as it says on the Haitian flag, which is their strength and unity.
The news center is not the only place in Boston to recognize L'Ouverture. In 2017, Boston Public Schools opened the Toussaint L'Ouverture Academy. That's a preschool that teaches in English and Haitian Creole. And he even got a shout-out as the namesake of T'Challa's son in the sequel to Marvel's Black Panther.
The second one, right? They go back to Haiti. They actually go to Haiti. So, and then the child's name is Toussaint also, right?
When the Toussaint L'Ouverture Cultural Center opens, it will have a library with Haitian literature and space for celebrations and community meetings. Nancy Asime is an executive committee member for the center and believes it will tie in directly to L'Ouverture's mission.
This provides the opportunity to really highlight who this historical figure, what he stood for, the ideals.
Although L'Ouverture was an architect of the nation, he never actually got to see an independent Haiti. The French captured him in 1802 and he died the following year. Haiti officially declared independence in 1804. Back outside the old State House, Charlot Lucien says Boston has been a historic hub of support to Haiti, especially given its deep abolitionist ties. In modern times, Boston has become a haven for refugees and immigrants from the Caribbean nation.
So it makes sense to exploit those historical connections and make sure that we move forward a certain agenda that will cement who we are and that will also contribute to booster Boston's reputation as a bastion of freedom and abolition.
The hope is to continue that connection well into the future. For the world, I'm Esteban Bustillos, Boston.
There is a wildlife preserve in Mozambique that is home to the big animals we tend to associate with Africa, like elephants and lions. It's also become a target of extremist violence. The latest about the Nyasa Reserve in Mozambique, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. Extremists linked to ISIS have driven thousands of people out of their homes in Mozambique. A recent series of attacks killed at least 10 people. The violence is taking place in an area called the Nyasa Reserve. It's one of the biggest tracts of conservation land in Africa. Martin Plaut is a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London. He explains why this region around the Nyasa Reserve is important beyond its wildlife.
Well, it is a very important area politically and economically, because it has huge gas reserves. The wildlife is marvelous. The huge, as you say, Nyasa Reserve, one of the largest in Africa, is, I'm sure, an absolutely beautiful place. Unfortunately, I've never been there, but I mean, it is magnificent, the area. But this huge reserves of gas, which were being extracted by Total Energy, that has been halted since 2021 after attacks by the Islamic State affiliated jihadi group Al-Shabaab. So that is not ongoing, but it's worth $20 billion. So if they can be, shall we say, halted and pushed back, then that could get going. And Mozambique would have a great deal of money, as would Total.
So is Islamic State Mozambique mostly interested in the gas and petroleum reserves, and the wildlife situation in Nyasa is kind of a collateral damage in this?
I think you'd be hard pushed to come up with a really, shall we say, rational ideology behind these Islamic states. They are very attractive because they offer sometimes money to people who join it. They also offer a very simple ideology. Go back to Islam as it once was in the 700s. That is the way to go forward. Reject colonialism, reject Christianity. That is their ideology. And it's the same across the continent. I mean, each one of these groups is specific to its location, but it is the same across Africa.
Right. And they're called Al-Shabaab in Mozambique, but there is no connection with Al-Shabaab in Somalia, correct?
No, they are linked to the Islamic State, not Al-Shabaab in Somalia. But these links are more ideological than anything else.
So I want to come back to Islamic State Mozambique in a moment, but Nyasa, I mean, this is a massive wildlife conservation zone, and it's been critical in bringing some species back from the brink of extinction. What has been the consequence of these Islamic State Mozambique attacks in the region?
Well, obviously, you know, the problem is that things like the elephant population was very badly damaged. Now, of course, one mustn't forget is that this is an area that was subjected to both enslavement and ivory trade going back to the 18th, 19th century, this is a hugely long period in time in which these areas have been predated on. And it goes back to what the Portuguese were doing there, what the Omanis were doing there. I don't know if you remember, but they were based in Zanzibar and they operated out of there. And they basically traded with local people. And they had long-term implications because they destabilized the tribal structures in these countries. And I'm afraid this is the residue which we're still sort of dealing with today.
So Islamic State Mozambique, this Al-Shabaab, they've been roiling northern parts of Mozambique for several years now. How active, in fact, are these militants today, and what is their movement into this Niassa Reserve? Tell us about the broader conflict.
Well, they are very effective and have plenty of weapons, most of which, of course, they capture from the forces that they are attacking. They also do have money because they extract them either by extorting from the local population, or they will also kidnap people in the special reserve, killing people, kidnapping, holding them ransom, and you either pay up or they will have no qualms about killing you, which is why it is so incredibly difficult to get rid of them. I mean, I just see no opportunity for ridding the area of groups like these, because they are ephemeral, they can be broken up into little groups, and they can reform again later. And of course, they use the kind of technology that we all do to keep in touch with each other, the mobile phone.
Martin, what is the broader political context of this violence? Like, why is this happening in Mozambique and not in other nations in southern Africa?
Groups like Al-Shabaab can operate in this kind of lawless area in the far north without hindrance, almost. I mean, they can cross into Tanzania, they can cross into Malawi if they have to. Who is going to fight them? So I'm afraid this is a region that is going to remain unstable. The gas is likely to remain in the ground. Places like the Niassa Special Reserve is likely to remain unvisited, because who would go there if you are in a situation where you're likely to be attacked and killed? I mean, you know, I couldn't recommend to any of my friends going there, beautiful as it is.
That's Martin Plowd, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London.
The 2025 Eurovision Song Contest wrapped up on Saturday. The competition pits pop singers from more than three dozen countries against each other. It is a campy spectacle like no other, laden with over-the-top stage shows and drama around electing a winner. This year's contest took place in Basel, Switzerland, where the top prize went to Austrian singer JJ for his song Wasted Love.
The Vienna-born singer performed in a floor-length leather coat while clinging to the mast of a ship as it navigated into fog machine-generated clouds of lost love. Wow. Here's JJ's reaction as he stepped up to accept his trophy.
Thank you so much for making my dreams come true, and especially thank you to you, Europe, for making my dreams come true.
JJ's victory was a nail-biter. Points in the competition come from a public vote and a jury vote. Each country's final score is a sum of the two.
Austria was neck and neck with Israel, which won the public vote by more than 100 points. But Austria dominated the jury vote, and that put JJ ahead. Israel's participation this year brought some controversy around the country's military campaign in Gaza. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez called for Israel to be banned.
Y por eso, creo que nadie se llevó las manos a la cabeza cuando se inició hace tres años la invasión de Rusia a Ucrania.
Sanchez pointed out that Russia has been banned from Eurovision since its 2022 invasion of Ukraine. He said, quote, "We must not allow for double standards in culture."
Pro-Palestinian demonstrations took place outside the venue in Basel on Saturday, and two protesters inside tried to climb on stage during the performance of Israel's contestant, Yuval Rafael. The two were stopped by security and escorted out of the venue.
Rafael has said the October 7th attacks on Israel motivated her to pursue singing. She was at the Nova Music Festival when Hamas gunmen struck that day, killing people around her.
The the World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.